Welcome to Magic in the Moment, Mindfulness in Real Time. My name is Clayton Platt, and I'll be your host for this podcast journey. Now, for many people, practicing mindfulness has very little to do with sitting on a cushion, lighting incense, or even focusing on their breath, just paying attention to what they're doing at any moment. And doing this intentionally can create that same magic. Our time together is intended to share how mindfulness plays out in everyday life for our guests. Now, before we begin, here's a word from our sponsor, Meditation for Leadership. We all feel it. The pressure to keep up, to perform, to push through. But lasting success doesn't come from speeding up. It comes from slowing down, leaning in, and creating the space to lead from within. That space is where we shift from autopilot to intention, building mindful habits that strengthen focus and calm. It's where we stay connected to our values and purpose, choosing to respond instead of react. It's where we unlock our potential to positively shape our own lives and empower others to grow and thrive. That's the work of Meditation for Leadership. If you're ready to create the space for sustainable success, visit meditationforleadership.org. Welcome. I'm Clayton Platt. I'm your host of Magic in the Moment, Mindfulness in Real Time. And my guest today is Greg Morley, and I'm thrilled to have Greg with us. And Greg has done extraordinary work around belonging and inclusion, huge career in human resources in Asia and Europe, working for companies like Disney and Hasbro and Moët Hennessy, and most recently is the author of a book called Bond, which really gets into the core of belonging and inclusion, and not only shares ideas around that topic, but also really creates a roadmap for how we can show up with more authenticity for ourselves and for others. So, Greg, I'm so glad to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you. And thank you for keeping our connection over many years. I think that really means a lot to me, Clayton.
Well, it means a lot to me as well. And thank you for recognizing that. So I'm reminded, Greg, that when we were talking before, you're now in London, at least temporarily. And if that's not the case, please disabuse me of that. But you were telling me about a time when you're in London in a taxi cab, and you're with a driver who's very quickly shown he's got some pretty strong political views, which might have been a little different from your own. And you're looking at your watch going, oh my God, this is going to be the most tedious half hour taxi cab ride I've ever had, because he's sharing a lot of views that are not landing with me. And it turned out in the end to be a little different. And I'd love you to kind of take me through that story, if you would.
Oh, great. What a great moment, and actually opened a lot of my eyes to how and why to have conversations with people that you may be avoiding. And actually, I'm living in Paris now, but I was in London, which is kind of like going to the shore if you live in the East Coast. It's a quick trip. And yes, I got into a taxi and I told the guy where I was going. And he said, oh, that's a real lefty part of town. But he didn't say it in a sort of like, oh, it's a lefty part of town. He said it, you know, like in a kind of derogatory way. So I did have that moment of looking at my map and seeing that it was about a 35-minute ride and wondering if I was going to engage with him. Or I just wanted to kind of be quiet and put my headphones in. But I thought, okay, this isn't a good moment to learn something. And we started talking about that. And we got into the very touchy topic of naming and pronouns and things like that. And he said, you know, I don't really understand that whole thing. So I asked him what his name was. And he said his name was Robert. And I said, would you be offended if I called you Bob? And he said, no, my name's Robert. And I said, but Bob's okay. If I call you Bob, that's okay, because it's kind of like Robert. And he said, no, I wouldn't really like that. And I said, well, that's a bit similar to how people, you know, they want to be called what they want to be called, regardless of what the label is. So we sort of came to a kind of understanding about calling people things and whether we agreed or we didn't. So it was an opener. And we got into this discussion about him liking cars and all this other kind of stuff. And he finally takes me to Clez, to where we're going. It was a very nice conversation. I learned a lot about him. I shared all kinds of things about myself to keep the conversation going, including that I was living in Paris with my husband and why I had moved here for my job. And finally, as we were getting closer, I could see on the map, he said, "Do you mind if I turn off the meter? I want to show you something." I said, "Sure." He seemed trustworthy. So he drove around the block in front of a door, and he said, "That's where I grew up. That's the house I grew up in." And I said, "Wow, you grew up in this lefty neighborhood." I said, "But now it seems quite safe." And he said, "Yeah," he said, "actually, the neighborhood has gotten a lot better. It's safer. It's cleaner." He said, "You wouldn't have walked around these parts when you were my age. You certainly wouldn't have come to dinner here." And I said, "Well, you know, things change, and sometimes it's for the better and sometimes for the worse." So I was really touched that in that moment of difference where we started, we got to a place where he was willing to show me where he'd grown up as a child. And I don't know that we became any closer in our beliefs of things, but we opened our eyes to the difference that each other had and the interest in that. And it started from a moment of great mindfulness, actually, because I did have to stop and think, take a deep breath, and decide to dive into that conversation rather than to avoid it. And I talk a lot about that in my book, which is, you know, we've come to a point in humanity where we avoid having conversations because we know we may be talking with people that have different opinions. And I think that that's something we have to get back to, is not to change people's minds, but to understand each other's viewpoints and try to stand in each other's shoes. And that kind of empathy is what's important. And it does create a sense of belonging and bonding to each other that I think is very important today, and especially in organizations, which is what was my background and expertise.
Mm. Well, I love that story, and I particularly appreciate the fact that you make that tie, as we're talking about, the mindful elements of that, where you probably could feel the emotions rising as he is expressing his views on lefties and whatever, and pronouns, etc., and kind of feeling that arising and then taking that deep breath and saying, okay, how are we going to do this? Am I going to get in an argument with him? Or am I going to have a discussion and find out a little bit more? Yeah. And I also applaud the use of that, you know, his name and using it. So what's your name? Robert. Do you mind if I call you Bob? Well, I do.
Right. Yes.
And right. Because you're talking about standing in each other's shoes, and you're giving him an example without preaching.
Yes.
Right? Which is so, so important. So that's a marvelous example of mindfulness in real time. And I really appreciate that. And I know that you've told me that you've got some mindfulness practice. You do yoga. And I'm really interested in our discussion today to kind of see how there are parallels, overlaps, interactions between the deep work that you're doing, the concepts in the book, which again resonate very deeply with me, and in your view, how it ties into these concepts of mindfulness and how they can be, in essence, practiced by lay people, right? Mm. We want to see the individual be able to embrace them, put it into their lives in a grassroots way that helps makes organizations more inclusive and creates a belonging culture.
More authentic, more meaningful. You know, I grew up in outside of Philadelphia, and I lived and went to school in university in Virginia. I lived in Orlando. I lived in California. And it's really where I started to learn the difference of culture, because we think about the U.S. as a kind of melting pot, but you move south of the border, so to speak, and you start to see that there's a really different culture. There's a very strong southern culture. There's a very strong culture in Florida and certainly one in California. And then I moved to France, and then I moved to Hong Kong, and then I moved to mainland China. And one of the things that I learned over that time is that for anybody to be effective in these different, in worlds of difference, so you know, where I grew up, maybe people were more like me. Where I went to school, I started to see people that were less like me. And then that just accelerated to a point where, you know, when I moved to Hong Kong, most people didn't even look like me anymore. So you have to really be thoughtful and mindful in the way that you interact with people. Or in our, especially as Americans, we're very free with our voice. We're very free with how we think. We're very free with our ideas. Whether they're right or wrong, it's we're brought up to, you know, have an opinion and speak up that opinion. And in many places around the world, opinions are to be raised when you're asked, or opinions are to be raised at your station or at your right level. And so if the boss flies in from another country and is more senior and starts saying, we need to do this, we need to do that, da, 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 without being thoughtful about taking a pause and really listening, you can be a disaster in your job. And I learned that over time about this. Most people come to work every day wanting to do a good job. Whether they do the good job or not is something different and is related to environments and their training and everything. Most people come to work every day wanting to treat other people well. And oftentimes what happens is when there's a disconnect there, as managers and as companies, we oftentimes fall into we fall into discipline rather than understanding. And there's a place for discipline and there's a place for, you know, the training and the hard words for people. But if you get back to the trying to understand that most people come to work trying to do a good job and something goes wrong, rather than just going after the what went wrong, trying to understand why something went wrong first and then what went wrong. And that takes mindfulness, that takes thoughtfulness, it takes the time to step back in a moment. I remember one time when I first got to Hong Kong and we were in a management meeting and something had happened where somebody's laptop had been taken, where they thought it had been taken, what disappeared. It was no longer where it was supposed to be. And from that moment to the, we're going to put cameras in the building, we're going to lock down all the computers, we're going to discipline people who don't leave their computers locked up, that took like maybe 30 seconds. Rather than, has anyone talked to the person who lost the laptop? Has anyone talked to anybody else? Could something else have happened? And it was like, okay, I remember watching this thing and observing it, kind of taking a breath and then diving in and saying, can we just take 5 minutes and try to understand what happened? And that is, you know, that's a method that I learned partly by doing yoga, is to say, you know, first of all, we are all living in moments, and let's not try to think or wish ourselves out of the moments, but also just to kind of take a pause and try to step back. And again, remember the best intent that most people bring to work so that we can take advantage of that goodwill and, you know, try to do our best as fellow humans working in a workspace.
That is devoutly to be wished. that ability, that awareness, I think I'm seeing a couple things there. I'm seeing the self-awareness of a leader to spot when they're being didactic. And, you know, it's my way or the highway. I want efficiency. I need this to be done. And thank you very much for just doing it and doing it efficiently versus perhaps taking a moment, as you saw, talking about that pause and thinking again and asking, what don't I know? And I think that story really, really illustrates that. It's like, what don't we know about this situation? And we want answers so quickly that we often don't ask that question. So there's that curiosity. And to me, curiosity is such a huge superpower. And I think it again, thinking about the themes of your work, it seems to arise in a lot of different ways. Yeah. But in that situation in particular, it's like, if we're not curious about what we don't know and what might have happened, and we want quick answers, we're not going to take that the time to find out. And we're potentially make decisions which are have consequences we didn't anticipate.
Absolutely. I think we all are familiar with the phrase, don't just stand there, do something. So somebody spills, you know, a glass of grape juice on a white carpet, or a child's about to run out into the traffic, or, you know, we're trying to save somebody from something. I work with, I have a good friend who I met in Hong Kong, and he did a lot of development work in East Africa. And, you know, a lot of the history of development is sort of the imposition of ideas from the West into underdeveloped locations that just, they work for a moment and then they don't survive. And their mantra was, don't just stand there, do nothing. And what did that mean? And it meant that it was most important to understand what was actually happening before they took action. Because the visceral reaction is you see starving children without water, is drill a well. But maybe that's not what needed to happen to save a village or save a community. And so I try to reflect on that, which is there is sometimes the need to don't just stand there, do something. But there's also times, probably more often, when we need to practice the don't just stand there and take the action of doing nothing for a while and really understanding, really being curious, really asking curious questions. And then, of course, we take action. You know, you talked about the leader. It's my way or the highway. I need you to do this. There's a place for that. I would say probably the early days of COVID, there just wasn't a lot of information. We just needed to move and make things happen and make sure that people were as safe as we could. In the rolling out days and months of COVID, being thoughtful and not acting sometimes was the wiser thing to do, because things were changing and we may have, and we did this, we applied things that didn't work or actually inhibited us to be more effective later. So being thoughtful, and as you said, the being curious is really a superpower. I mean, really trying to understand people and understand their motivations, understand what's happening at home as to why they got to work late. Rather than penalizing them for being late, is a way to ultimately build connection with people and also build their bond with your organization. So you want to get people that feel like they belong in your company, but they also want to stay, and they're tied to the way to the place you're trying to take the organization, and that happens through being curious and getting to know people.
So the world right now, and I think I've shared with you that, you know, I've done work around DEI, done some training work in corporations. From a personal standpoint, it really resonated, that overall topic of inclusion and equity and belonging has really resonated deeply with me. And it's helped me sort of understand my particular privilege and own it. And that's fine. So one of the things that I was interested in chatting with you today about was, in the years that you've been involved with this large subject topic, things have changed and it's evolved. And currently it's under a microscope might be perhaps a misnomer. It's under a sledgehammer. But I think you've got some interesting thoughts about how we can take a step back and use the concepts that are at the core in a way that end up bringing more people to the table. And it sort of goes back to that conversation with the cab driver, right? And I wonder if you could expand on that a little bit.
So I remember back when I first joined Disney, and I joined Disney in the late 1990s. and in Florida. And I found out when I joined that there was a gay employee resource group. And I thought that was like incredible. Like I never heard anything like that. And I went to the meeting and it was nice to meet other people who were in the community. And when I reflect back on that, what I realize is that, you know, there was a resource group for gay and lesbian employees. There was a resource group for women. There was a resource group for veterans and parents. But those resource groups never really made a huge difference. Why? You know, then I have to look back, like, why is it now like 25 or 30 years later that we're still trying to make progress in this area? And my belief is that those resource groups created a safe space for people, but because they never were really designed to kind of enlarge the bubble or bring in people who were willing to kind of play the game of enlarging the bubble that were outside of those communities, then they really never had had much impact other than safe space. Safe space is important, but if you want to make real change, you have to hold hands with other people as allies and advocates. And so what I think is, as we, you know, moved over time, that concept did not change that much. And where I have some hope out of this period of time of the sledgehammer is a bit of kind of breaking the old structures that may have existed, which may have prevented some of the underrepresented groups from working together with the majority groups or with the privileged to make progress. And, you know, we have to think about, in an organization, diversity makes a difference. It makes a statistical difference in terms of the ability for organizations to create ideas and for the ability of organizations to spot risk. If you have a diverse organization in an inclusive culture, those organizations are more creative and they're financially more sustainable. If you then have leaders who can manage those organizations are six times more likely to outperform their peer groups. So that data exists. It's been done across many studies across many places in the world. And our mission as leaders of organizations has got to be to remind people that that's what it is. So if I go back to the first part, which is difference or diversity, you know, the old white guy is as diverse and has a unique point of view as I do, or as a, you know, a person from a different country, or as a person with a disability. We all bring something unique in our experience. We all bring something unique in our perspective. And it's that bringing those unique perspectives and people being able to talk up, speak up, bring their ideas to the table. That is why, you know, those organizations do better. It's not to say that managing in those organizations is particularly easier. It's probably a higher degree of sophistication and it takes training, like the training I'm sure you were doing for companies. But those managers are the ones that are also sought out. So, you know, my other, you know, call out in this area is that there is a shrinking population of really talented people who can move in different environments, who are flexible, who are agile, who are resilient. And it's those people that have worked in multicultural, multi-ethnic, multiracial, multi-generational environments, and they've been able to work and thrive in those environments, that are the ones that are going to be sought by the best companies. And back to the sledgehammer, the best companies, the ones that really understand this, are the ones that are not walking away from their commitments in terms of inclusive workplace and diverse work cultures, and diverse work population, because they know that that's what's going to give them the competitive advantage to their competitors and their peer groups.
I've been thinking a lot about the messaging, and hearing that response from you, first of all, in my heart, I have a strong sense of support for the research that's been done and I embrace it. You know, I preach it where possible, but it makes perfect sense. And I think about the neuroscience of groupthink and how if you put, you know, five Episcopal Academy, you know, UVA, Princeton, whatever, you know, people in a room, you're going to have a pretty small, sample size. Mm-hmm. And you're going to reinforce a lot of the same thoughts. Some of those thoughts are being great, and some of them are going to be like, you know, they don't play outside of New Jersey. But a couple of things come to my mind. And one is that being able to get that message out that, look, creating a diverse workplace is not simply to create spots for people who don't deserve them. And I think that's the messaging right now. I hear from, you know, the media that is pushing back. It's like, you know, people have been given spots that don't deserve it because that's a DEI hire.
Right.
And the flip side is that you and I would agree, but how does this get stated in a way that says this isn't, someone hasn't been hired simply because they look differently and they don't deserve the job. What we've tried to do is lower the obstacles for the people who do deserve to be there, mm-hmm. to be competing for those jobs. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I think two ways I think about DEI hire, the term DEI hire. One is that people that have access, people that have the privilege of an education, the privilege of resources, that's what I would consider a DEI hire. So that person probably has gotten to where they are, you know, may have gotten to where they are without merit. So they've actually done it on sort of the back of somebody else, whether that's a legacy, whether that's because they had the resources, whatever that is. So I think about it actually the other way around, which is, you know, if DEI hire means somebody was given an opportunity because of who they are or where they came from, yes, that has been happening for hundreds of years. And so let's change the script on it. And as you said, let's open the door to everybody. I worked for a CEO who was very explicit about this, and he was certainly no philanthropist, and he was very clear about that. To him, diversifying the organization was about becoming more innovative and becoming more creative and surviving as a company. And his view was, if you have two candidates and they're equally qualified, I want the one that has the unique experience. So they may have come from outside this particular industry. They may have had a different upbringing. They may have lived in different places around the world. They may have had some trauma in their background, which they recovered from. So something that makes that person uniquer or more unique in their experience, that's the person I want, because that person's going to bring something to its management team table that the other person, you know, to the point of groupthink, may not.
That makes total sense to me. And I think it's a wonderful observation. And I love the fact that as you described this person, it wasn't that they were a bleeding heart.
No,
it was self-interest, right? It was self-interest that they wanted to pursue some different thinking and bring uniqueness to the table to give them a leg up. I love that.
His view was, you know, we're a global company. The biggest businesses we have should, you know, our workforce should reflect those consumers. And that company did not at all recommend that. So you had a lot of people in one country that were developing product for different places around the world without the perspective really of those places, unless they went there on a business trip. And that's not really a great way to learn a place, because, you know, a senior manager goes on a business trip, I can tell you, they don't see the normal life of the day-to-day people that are buying the product. They see the best hotel, the best restaurant, the best presentation, all this other stuff. So he was very wise in his seeing through what the company needed to be competitive. And that was, the company's workforce should reflect the consumer, And we need people that are willing to bring fresh ideas and unique and creative ideas. And that will make us successful.
Interesting. So I'm thinking about your experience in different countries, different regions, different cultures. And I don't want to put you on the spot, but did you learn different languages?
I studied French in high school. But what I realized in the U.S. system of studying is you study to test, you don't study to speak. So I was an average student, so my French level was pretty average when I eventually came to France, and then I started to pick it up. I learned it. When I left France, you know, I arrived in France speaking one language relatively well, which was English. When I left France, I spoke two languages poorly because I had lost a lot of my English and I had picked up just enough French to be understandable. But what I learned about that, especially in a country like this, is when you learn the language, you have a much greater insight into the culture, to how people think about things, the way they describe things. Food is so important in this culture. And then I went to Hong Kong. I started to learn the language. It was very difficult to learn. I'm very good at giving out Chinese New Year red packets, these things that you give out at Chinese New Year. So I have all the different terms. And then when I went to China, the same thing. I learned a little bit of the language. But again, not because I thought I was going to be fluent in the language, but because the language is a door into the culture. It's a door into the way people are talking with each other. And I wish I had learned those languages better, but I committed myself when I moved back to France to speaking French well. And so now I every day I'm doing some French learning, and I love it because I read a lot of French history and a lot of French cultural books in English, but I have a much greater understanding because I've learned the language better to connect the two things and operate, I think, more respectfully in my context. And more thoughtfully too, because I could barrel my way through Paris every day in English without a problem. But I really want to be, a kind of considerate citizen as long as I am here. And I learn more about it; it's more enriching for me.
Yeah, I think that Ernest Hemingway, I'm going to paraphrase this, said to be fluent in another language is to have another soul. And what I was hearing you say, that even without fluency, you were appreciating the linguistic differences and understanding that there's certain ways that people say things that indicate what's important to them.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I learned that living in Cali, Colombia for a couple of years and becoming fluent and then really having a total different relationship with the people in that country, when I could start to appreciate, this is how they're looking at it. So, I tip my hat to your commitment, even again with difficult languages like Chinese, or, knowing that it wasn't easy for you to learn French, but saying, but I'm still going to be committed to seeing what are the tip offs here? What are the clues about what's important to the Parisians? The French, because also in different parts of a country. Yeah. They will have different idioms, right? And we've got them in the U.S. Yes. Or English, right? What is it? The similar language separating different cultures. Again, I've bastardized that, but between Scottish and Irish and British and New Zealand and Canada, we all speak the same language, sort of, but in different ways. And the things that are important to us tend to show up in our idioms. So.
Yeah, it goes back to the idea of curiosity and sort of welcoming people into your world. When I lived here 20 something years ago, when I first worked for Disney in France, the relative language level of English was very low, much lower than it is now. The problem I have now is I go into a restaurant and I start speaking French, and I speak it with such a American accent that 8 times out of 10, they will just change the channel into English. But what I recognize is that I've already shown them some respect by a curiosity of that. I've tried to learn the language. So my language, my speaking may not be great. It's understandable. It's functional. But that opens doors as well. And I think that that, you know, is, it's reflective of how I think about people coming to work. You know, if you're curious about them, you may not get it all right. You may, you know, as we talked earlier, you may name them the wrong thing. If you do it with a sense of curiosity and you do it with good intent and good meaning, then that's going to open doors for people, and it'll make people feel like, okay, this person respects maybe the difference that I bring to the workplace, and this person respects me as an individual. And maybe they called me something incorrect, but we can work that out. I can give that person that feedback later. I notice that here differently when I start with French, and even if people change the channel, they're much more engaged with me than they would have been if I just walked in and said, you know, howdy y'all, do you have, you know, French fries here, and whatever my entry into any location would be.
I love it. So we've touched, I think, subtly on these elements of sort of mindfulness in real time, and curiosity being a huge part of that. And I'm wondering, you know, going back to some of the other aspects of the book, you know, I'm thinking about, I was looking at the five keys, mm-hmm. right? And looking at, like, I think I made some notes, so forgive me for looking over, but visibility, voice, validation, vulnerability, and values. And we don't have to go through all of them, but from the standpoint of our topic here, of how they play out, mm-hmm. and how we can bring a sense of presence and mindfulness to achieving these, where would you put your first focus, and how might that play out in real time?
I really believe that organizations that are committed to some set of values are important, and again, also more successful. I was lucky to work for a company like Disney, where through sort of thick and thin, it can draw itself back to the values of Walt Disney. I mean, I worked at Disneyland for a number of years, and you could feel this Walt Disney spirit in the park, even 50 years later. And that's a feeling of value. And again, you know, we talk about the current environment where some companies are walking away from their commitments on inclusion and diversity. I would estimate it, and I know some of those companies, they do not have particularly strong value sets. They could be very successful operations. They have different ways of running their business, but their values are maybe not as strong as some other companies. And values are important because you can always go back to that. And so in this work, I think it's important that organizations have value. And then I think values that are explainable, that can be shared, and that are understandable. And then I think the next is that people in the organization have a voice. And it's not easy for everyone in an organization to have a voice, because there are more senior people around the table. I don't speak the language of this organization, either the cultural language or it's a second or third language which people are speaking. And so how do I get my ideas out? And that's something that's important also in terms of mindful leadership, that, you know, when I'm sitting around a table of, say, 8 or 10 people on my team, most often in the last 15 years of my life, English was not their first language. They may have spoken it very well because they were hired as that was one of the things they were hired. But they may not think in English. They may be translating everything. And for those of us that have learned a second language, you know the effort that it goes through to, you know, take it in, put it in the machine, retranslate it, and then try to speak. Well, you know, if you're working for an American boss, I'm like 5 topics ahead by the time that person has processed all of my earlier gibberish. And so you have to be mindful in leadership to slow down, to speak clearly, and then to stop and give people the chance to engage. And oftentimes, even then, people will not just naturally engage because it's not their culture to speak up to more senior people. Again, they may be new in the organization. They may not have understood what I said. So my practice is always to say, to call people and say, what did you think? I haven't heard from you in a while. Do you have anything you want to add? And give people the voice. You can hire great people, but unless they feel like there's equity in the room so that they can be part of the conversation, then their ideas are going to be left. And I am sure that I could go back in history and identify that a lot of the best ideas come from the people that speak the least. And so it's our job to, you know, stand down a bit, be thoughtful about the way we're interacting and running meetings with people, put ourselves in their shoes to know that they may be struggling with language and concepts, and it doesn't make them dumb. It just makes the role of the leader, it's more imperative to be thoughtful, to be curious, and to allow people to have a voice. And so I think those two things are really important in terms of successful businesses.
I love the thought of taking that pause and making sure that everybody's with you, right? And also encouraging the quiet voices. Mm. You know, I grew up, not surprisingly for the people who know me, a little bit extroverted. So it's never been a problem for me to speak up. As a facilitator, learning to be the guide on the side and not the sage on the stage, it's like, shh, like find out, because the wisdom comes often from the quiet.
Yes.
And the other thing with the language, I was just thinking about this and how even people, total Native American speakers, or I don't think that came out right, but people for whom English is their first language, and using acronyms, and in business it's happening so much, right? And we throw these acronyms out and I'm like, my eyes are crossing. It's just like, it doesn't make sense to me.
I went to a different, when I left France, I spoke two languages poorly. One of the reasons was I had to sort of intentionally cleanse idioms out of my English. So my English became very mechanical in a way. I mean, even the way I speak now to you is different than the way I would have spoken to you 20 years ago, because I've just had to build in this kind of pace into my speaking, in this maybe slower pace, less complicated language, and that's important to understand if people are with you, and as maybe more important to understand when people are not. And, you know, a boss has a great idea and she runs with that idea. He runs with that idea. He's, you know, encouraging everybody to come along, and everybody's standing there like, this is going to be a disaster. And, you know, the boss doesn't give the opportunity to speak up. It can become a disaster. And, you know, I had that situation happen to me when I was just at, had gone to Disneyland, and I was like all fired up because I had been to this, one of the first trainings that we went to was diversity training. And at the time, this is again, like in the late 90s, we were really being trained to not insult people. That was like the main theme of the training, if I think back to it. And, you know, that everybody had to sort of have this kind of equal offering. So I arrive at Disneyland. I'm the head of recruitment. And in Disneyland, they have a big recruitment center. It's almost like you're in the theme park. And the recruitment center is right across from the parking garage where 1,000 people come in to work every day. So I show up one morning, as I would always get there early in the morning. I'm still living on Florida East Coast time. And there's a huge Christmas tree in the what's called the casting center. And I said, do we celebrate any other traditions at this time of year, or we just put up a Christmas tree? So my team's looking at me like, I don't know what you're talking about, other traditions. And so I said, you know, do we have a Hanukkah representation? Do we do something for Kwanzaa? And again, they look at me like I have no idea what I'm talking about. So I got in touch with the facilities people and I said, can you put anything else in here to kind of make it a more equal representation? Because I don't, you know, want the applicants who come in, they see this big Christmas tree, but there's nothing else to sort of balance it out. It's Christmas time, by the way. And it's not like they put it in July. And they said, well, we can do it next year, but we can't do it this year. And I said, I think we should take it out because it's just too explicit of a representation of a Christian holiday. And we haven't represented anything else. Anyway, without consulting my team, I gave them the direction to take this thing out. So I was not listening to anybody, but I thought I was right. And there's nothing worse than being right and being so committed to it that you don't talk to other people and challenge your assumption. So anyway, the next morning I come in, peak time, everybody's coming out of the parking garage into work. One of the guys that worked on my team came into my office and he said, you need to come out and see this. And I came out and see it, and the facilities team was dragging this enormous Christmas tree across this huge concrete walkway, you know, glass ornaments shattering everywhere. People looking, my team standing behind me looking at me like, you know, we told you so if you just listened to us. And this Grinch, you know, that stole Christmas moment that I had was a great reminder of, you know, when I look back, like I had never stopped to seek input. I had never tried to understand the tradition of that place and why that was such an important representation, and also why they didn't have any other representation. And it was the lowest point of my journey into thoughtful leadership. And I learned a lot from that moment. And I tell that story in the book because I think it's an important moment for me to, it's important for me to share my failures as well, because that's how I learned to be a better listener to my team and to be a more effective leader of people.
That need to be right. Where does that get? Yeah. Oh, it's huge. Right. We're wired that way. Right. And we, you know, our ego is screaming at us, you know, protect yourself because, you know, people are challenging you, but you know, you're right. And I'm thinking of all the different ways that manifests itself. Certainly what you've done is illustrate in the managerial role, how it can be a huge mistake and a breaker of morale in a major way, right? We can think about this in our relationships. I think about that in my relationship with family and my kids. But I'm also thinking about in our relationship across political divides. And, you know, if there's one thing that seems to really present itself in a big way is people's need to be right. And to never step back and take that stance of like, well, let me figure out what's missing, as we talked about earlier, what's missing, what am I not taking into account, and what is supporting this need for me to be right? Because often it's something totally removed from this particular subject.
Yeah.
I would bet dollars to donuts that the issue of the Christmas tree versus other, manifestations of cultural celebration was not as deeply rooted as something else in Greg's life that said, I need to establish in my managerial position that, you know, what I say is accepted and put into action. Is that fair?
Yeah. And I had just come from this training class where they had taught us, you know, right from wrong. And I'm, you know, I would say, you know, raised in a very sort of morally right or wrong kind of way. I'm not an absolutist, but I think I usually try to be that person. And one of the things that I've learned over time is being right is not a key to being successful. It can be an important pillar. But if I reflect on sort of the current climate and current situation and why there's been such a retraction of a focus on something that is factually proven to be effective for organizations, it's that, you know, we led with what was right rather than trying to get everybody into the conversation to understand each other's feelings, differences, strengths, and try and move things together in one path. And that takes negotiation. It takes, you know, maybe I'm not going to get 80% of what I want or 60% of what I want, and somebody else will feel like they got 60% of what they want. That's the way humanity moves forward in progress, and the way companies work together as well. So if we can do it in companies, we should be able to do it in the larger society. And again, when I started writing the book, I could see that this topic was getting farther and farther away from the facts and more to the emotion. But in the emotion, that's where people feel they're standing and right. And my hope is to bring people back to a kind of a middle ground where we can have more conversation, we can have disagreement, but we do it with positive intent. We do it in a thoughtful way, in a curious way. And ultimately, like the taxi driver, we probably don't get 100%, you know, I wasn't sitting in the front seat by the end of the taxi ride, but we had, you know, come to a place where he's showing me where he grew up. So that was I had somehow come closer to him and he had come closer to me. And that's, I think, what we can ask for and hope for in being thoughtful and more mindful towards others.
Yeah, being open and being willing to share sometimes the space for someone, letting them express what's important to them, and being surprised sometimes by, oh, we have a little bit more in common than I thought, but allowing that openness of conversation. And I think the stepping back from the need to be right, getting off the high horse.
Yeah.
And just saying, okay, let me hear this story. It's like, oh. And then you're saying, we got way more in common than I thought.
Yeah.
And interestingly, we talk about like where the decisions are made and should we be doing it emotionally or intellectually. And in fact, at the end of the day, decisions are most often made emotionally. But that can be okay if what we've allowed is that whole process, right? So we've had an emotional response. We've taken a step back. So we've tried to practice our mindfulness in pausing before we react and before we make a decision, and then take in more of the data, so to speak,
yeah,
and be inclusive in soliciting that and then listening to it and making sure that it's not just a cursory, oh, I get that. But wait a minute, tell me a little bit more. I make sure I understand a little bit more. And then I think we make a decision from a collective standpoint and it's an emotional yes.
Yes.
And I think that reinforces what you were talking about before about corporate culture, mission, values, and those organizations that explicitly share throughout their levels what their values are and do it in a way that people can understand and get behind. Mm-hmm. And I think there are things like Disney where you've got some ritual.
Yeah.
And there's a huge, I think there's a huge factor where ritual and doing things in groups where we're all now collectively behind a specific mission and value that gets us sort of on the same team, right?
Yeah, exactly. And when people feel like they belong in an organization like that or a team like that, and they have a kind of bond to those rituals and that mission, they're going to work just a little bit harder. than an organization that doesn't. They're going to do just a little bit beyond what they've been contracted to do. They might go a couple hours longer one night, or they might come in on a weekend, or they might work from home, or they might just be thinking about work in a non-work setting. And those companies are the ones that win, because people feel like, okay, this is my company. I have some, they have some obligation to me. I have an obligation to them. I have a bond with what they want to do. I know where they're going. And, you know, again, managers that nurture that and foster that, it's not their soft skills for hard benefit. And, you know, I've seen that time and time again in my career, and whether it's different companies or even different teams, where organizations and leaders that can practice those kinds of, you know, helping people to be brought along, helping people to feel like they belong, helping people to feel like they're connected, those organizations win. And in business, it's about winning. And so that's why, you know, I go back to the, you know, the practices of being mindful is a winning practice, because it does help people to succeed.
It does. It helps people feel valued, mm-hmm. feel appreciated. And I want to share that I value and appreciate you, Greg. I have for a long time. And we did connect years and years and years ago. And I appreciate the fact that as social media allowed me to stay in touch with your career, and I reached out, it's like, who's this guy? But literally, you know, we have something at our core that we shared, and, you know, that's an alma mater. But I am a huge fan of your work.
Thank you.
I appreciate it deeply, and I am very grateful for the time that we spent today. It's been even a greater joy than I anticipated, so thank you for that.
Well, thank you for being interested in the work. It means a lot to me coming from you. And I always love to journey with people through different contexts and different phases of life. And I feel like we've done that through our shared connections over time. And you've always made me feel very appreciated.
As always, I want to thank our guests today for sharing their stories, as well as my producer, Marianne Sanders, for all her work behind the scenes, and finally for the support of my friends at Meditation for Leadership through their sponsorship. Until next time, this is Clayton Platt reminding you to look for those moments of magic in your life that lead to mindfulness in real time.